on March 23rd, Akira Kurosawa would have turned 100 years old. Yes, I am running a little late on applauding the man for 100 years of life, even though he's probably been dead since September of 98. So, what is it? This would be the 12th year he died of his death. So, anyway, in the honor of his 100th year birthday, a lot of people are doing a lot of things. And I wanted to continue on a continuing saga of working and talking about the man's work. We've done this before with Mr. James from Dried Blood. This is a solo show in honor of Akira Kurosawa today on Motion Picture Massacre.
春のゴールデンウィークに東宝が自信を持って全映画ファンに送る黒沢明監督の用心棒はすでに撮影も竹縄三船敏郎の用心棒をめぐって数々の興味ある事件が火花を散らす関八州の無法地帯真の目の宿のオープンセットでは巨匠黒沢明の目が本で入念なリハーサルを重ね着々と撮影が進められています。 映画の楽しさ面白さをこの一編に込める超娯楽大作「用心棒」の完成にご期待ください。時刻は今夜の牛密、場所は万屋の辻。分かったな。
なかなかやるな。もっと面白いことになるぜ。
Was the trailer for Yojimbo and the music in the film. Yojimbo is written by Rozo Koisama and Akira Kurosawa and directed by Akira Kurosawa. Produced by the Toho Company and was released. It was released in 1961. Kurosawa is considered one of the most Western Japanese directors of all time. So the work he was doing at the time was pretty much transcended all countries. You can show a film of his in America with the subtitles, people would get it and understand it and enjoy it. It was very high, his films were very highly recommended. And they still are to me, even to this day. I've never been a big fan of his films. It's not like I never heard of him and I've been kind of blowing it off. It's just with all the amount of film that's put out every year and all the years that a film has been out, and you kind of, Akira Kurosawa has a kind of a wall to climb of, you know, the clout, the expertise, the kind of films he does put out. So when I wanted to tackle it originally, I asked James, who is a huge fan of Akira Kurosawa, to come with me and talk about two films. And we talked about Throne of Blood and Redbeard, two other Mifune films. Trying to remember, because I know Redbeard is the last film that him and Toshirô Mifune did as a collaboration. And that's just mainly because of just conflicts with Redbeard, is the fact that he had to keep his beard well-maintained and well-maintained, and he wasn't able to get another job as Mifune. So he kind of stopped working with Akira Kurosawa after that. This film was made in 61. We're talking about Yojimbo, the first. And the second film, and we're talking about Shinjiro, the sequel to Yojimbo, which was made the following year in 62. So he would pretty much do two more films with Kurosawa before he would end his partnership with him. And Throne of Blood was done in 57. So we did one film in 57, we did one in 63, and now we're doing the 61 and 62 films. There's plenty of films that he's done over the years, you know, from all the way from 1943 up until his... his retirement. Well, actually, I think he stopped doing films in 93, and then he subsequently died in 98. And the thing is, for the most part, I think everything Akira Kurosawa has been made, in the States anyway, has been released through the Criterion. If you look through any other ones, I think BFI owns and releases a bunch of them. You got to go through many different European countries to find different versions of the film. I did a little research on this, so if you do want to rent these films and you do want to talk, you want to watch them for yourselves, Love Film in Europe has them available for rent, and so does Zip.ca has them available for rent. It's the kind of the Netflix equivalent of these two companies. And Netflix does. You can actually stream them, and you can get them via disc if you want a disc. I prefer the disc because you get the commentaries and whatnot, and I like having the commentaries. Anyway, so Yojimbo, like I said, stars Toshirô Mifune. And pretty much that's the only person I'm really going to talk about. I mean, Mifune's character, Sanjiro, Kabanawata Sanjiro, which means 33-year-old mulberry bush, or 30-year-old mulberry bush, is just something that he makes up on the fly. There's the way this thing is that Sanjiro, a ronin, a master of the samurai, roams into this small town, realizes that it's been corrupted by two warring factions, and makes it his job. No, okay, better way. He makes it his fucking quest to get rid of them any way he can. And it's pretty much like a big game of poker. Yet he's got the best fucking, you know, hand that he can have. And he's, you know, he has a shit hand, but he's able to pretty much con both crowds into killing each other. Just by the ways of doing things. So he comes into town, pretty much finds out by a local merchant of what's going on, that you have these two roaming gangs, and it's pretty much one gang is an offshoot of another, because when the main boss died, he gave the leadership to his son, and one of his higher ranking men said that was bullshit, and he started his own gang. And then you find out that one gang is aligned with the mayor, who is the biggest silk merchant in town, and then the other gang is aligned with the sake merchant. So you have that pitting against them: the sake merchant, the silk merchant, the two biggest moneymakers in town are also pinned against them. You have some of the comic relief in the film is the law in the film is this kind of dittering, kind of goofball character. Who only comes out he comes out at the beginning when Sanjiro walks in and tells him to go down this stretch of the town, and when men come out, just, you know, show them your force and they won't mess with you. And he's pretty much just wanting to start, you know, shit between people, and he doesn't really care because he's corrupt, and all he does is pretty much come out and tell the time. And he's probably one of the lighter moments of the film, along with Mifune's character in general. Mifune's character is pretty much just kind of walking around, smiling, and, you know, giggling to himself about what he's doing. So he makes fast alliance with one of the gangs by killing a bunch of the men of another gang, and he's pretty much for the highest bidder. You know, he tries to get as much money as possible. And the whole thing with the money system in that time period is really freaking complicated, and it's really not worth talking about because this is supposed to be, I forget what time period this is supposed to be. Anything online, you really can't fucking get anything because they don't tell you. So he goes in, he makes alignment with one gang, and he kind of subsequently hears the leader of that one gang plot with his wife and his son to kill him in the midst of battle. So he pretty much, you know, says, you know, screw you, and he goes to the other gang. Or he actually doesn't go to the other gang first. He actually goes in the middle of town as both the gangs are about to get ready to fight. And he just sits there and waits for them. He sits there in the bell tower and waits for them both to kill each other. You know, pretty much very simple. But, you know, a little kink in his plans. The inspector comes to town and kind of fucks everything up. Because everybody's supposed to look like they're, the town isn't completely falling apart because of gambling and whatnot. So he realizes what's going on. Even though the inspectors are corrupt as well, you know, everyone seems to be corrupt. Everyone who's higher and higher offices seems to be corrupt. And he just tries to make it his best to cause the end of both, you know, of both these people, both these gangs, as best he can. A lot of people say that Kurosawa, in his best ways, he did source some plot aspects from a film noir film called The Glass Key in 1942. Also, a lot of people think that he used the Dashiell Hammett novel, Red Harvest, yes. He used the Dashiell Hammett novel, too, because Red Harvest, to my knowledge, I've never read the book, but what I've heard from Stephen Thompson's podcast, if you go to Stephen, I'll put this out as a notation to check out, but episode 9 of Stephen Thompson's podcast, Just Another Fucking Movie Podcast, he did a whole episode on Red Harvest. It's a whole great thing. I mean, the book sounds very interesting. I'm actually trying to find a copy, but I don't have the time to really read. And I'm trying to find an audio version of the book so I can actually sit down and listen to it at work, because that would be a much more interesting time. But the book, Red Harvest, is of an operative coming into a town, realizing that it's corrupt, and both two corrupt groups are in it, and he decides to destroy them outright, make it his duty to destroy them. The character has no name. He's only known as an operative. I can't remember exactly what title it is. Yojimbo is kind of loosely translated to the bodyguard. But Shinjiro is really not his name. Shinjiro Kadawata. Kadawata Bataka. Because Ronins or samurai are supposed to have these kind of noble names, and he just makes it up on the fly in the middle of a conversation. He just looks outside, and there's a whole bunch of mulberry bushes, and he just makes it up. And he even does this in Shinjiro. He actually calls himself... I gotta look up. Well, we'll get to that. But in Red Harvest, it's pretty much the same kind of story, but Kurosawa, when asked, he said he knew of the book and the story, but he didn't particularly use that as part of his thing, because Kurosawa was very open with where he got his story ideas and whatnot. So if you take it from a book, he would tell you, you know... There's a scene in the film where Mifune gets kidnapped by the rival gang. This is after the other gang has destroyed the other gang, and they've pretty much taken up the whole town. And they've taken him hostage, because this whole thing happens where they're trying to do... they've taken two people hostage, and it's one for one, pretty much. So they're trying to trade, but... Shinjiro comes in and kills everybody and gets that one person freed. And he causes the death of all these, you know, people who are guarding this one captive. And they kind of figure out that it was him who caused the fight, not the warring class, even though after they've already killed the other gang. So they take him hostage and beat him almost half to death, but he's able to escape because a lot of the henchmen of this gang member's men are kind of retarded. He's able to escape, you know, half alive. And the merchant that's kind of been his friend and his colleague throughout this whole thing has kind of been explaining to him and telling him what's going on without them realizing that he's playing both sides without them either noticing, which is great. You know, helps him try to survive and brings him back somewhat to health. And that scene where they hold him hostage and beat the hell out of him was a scene out of Glass Key, which is a film you actually should check out if you really like film noir stuff, which I think is also another Dashiell Hammett novel. Now, this film there's been a plenty of film that take the same knowledge. You know, and overall, Shinjiro is able to... get the upper hand and pretty much take out both teams. And what the great thing is that he's able to cape out when the one gang gets an old adversary back and he has a modern day weapon, because these are supposed to be, I think, 1500, 1600, something like that. So, like around the time the Americans showed up to, the Japanese shores with their modern weaponry, so cannons and handguns and rifles and whatnot. This film has been adapted or kind of, some people say, ripped off by Sergio Leone for his film Fistful of Dollars. In Leone's film, it's pretty much, and the thing is, with this film, Yojimbo, it kind of did start the whole idea of spaghetti western, because Leone and Sergio Corbucci both saw this film and wanted to make their own version of Yojimbo. Leone did it more or less pulling no punches and technically taking the full story and only modifying things and putting it in The Man with No Name, his first film, Fistful of Dollars, pretty much using the whole story and changing it to a modern Western, instead of, because Kurosawa took the John Ford style of Western and retroverted it into a samurai style, the samurai times. So Leone took what Kurosawa did with John Ford and brought it into the samurai time, and then he took what Kurosawa did and then modified it to a modern spaghetti western style, which, even though, and there was lawsuits about the whole thing, that's why the Fistful of Dollars took so long to get to the States is because technically, you know, the people say he ripped it off, but I think it's a loving homage to Yojimbo. But also Carbucci, who saw the film and said, you know, I want to do my own. He did a film called Django, which is another take on the whole thing, but it's also a more, it's not a complete pull off. This is more of a modern homage to Yojimbo. And the thing is, I like both the films, and I really, you know, and it's for the genre, because after those two films were created, you know, every other Italian friggin' Burgermeister director just peeled from either the Man with No Name trilogy or from Django. Or they just pretty much named it Django just so they can get people to go see the damn movie. They didn't care if it wasn't something else. Also, films like Lucky Number 11 and Tsukiyaki Western Django, the Takashi Miike film that came out a couple years ago, are also modern takes on Yojimbo. And there's plenty of films, if you look at it, and you think of, you know, a one man in the middle of two different gangs trying to get them both to kill each other by playing his sides. Any film that's going to get that same kind of quintessential makeup or quintessential storyline, it's pretty much taking off of Yojimbo. You know, and overall, it's a fantastic film. It's something that should be definitely listened to, you know, watched by all. And I'm not going to give you everything because I think there's a lot of merit in the film and merit, and there's a lot of comedy. It's a dark film, but there's a lot of comedic moments in the film, especially the way Shinjiro Mifune's character kind of relates to things. He at times doesn't really care, and he doesn't mind that he's destroying these people and killing them, but he's not killing them himself. He's not doing it by his own hand. He's forcing the two groups to kill themselves. You know, when you do see him actually kill someone, he's killing them out of kind of defense. Like the scene where he helps rescue the woman from the one gang. He kills all these, you know, all these bodyguards and all these samurai that are sitting in the thugs and that are staying in there watching this woman. He kills them all because that's the only way he can get around with it, to cause the other gang to go and kill the other gang. You know, but for the most part, when he does attack people, he attacks them with his sword in sheath. You know, and he's able to use, you know, blocking techniques and techniques with his sword to get people to fall without actually hurting them physically with the blade, which is it's a great way to think. And the thing is, what I think the problem with Tanjiro, the sequel in 62, is that there's more. Mifune's character, Shinjiro itself, uses his sword a lot more. Not just, you know, a sheath sword, but uses his sword for full effect and kills a lot of people because of it. So, why don't we listen to a bit of music from Shinjiro and the trailer for Shinjiro, and we'll get right into that film.
なったら死にも生きるも我々国住人だ。てめえらのやること危なくて見せられねえや。 金魚の運行みたいに繋がってこられちゃ始末がいいな。どっかおとなしく片付いてるとこねえのか。
Because of the popularity of Yojimbo, Kira Kurosawa was going to do a film called, I can't think of it now. See, the thing is, my brain is completely, oh, Peaceful Days. He was going to adapt a story called Peaceful Days, but the film was so, Yojimbo was so successful that Toho wanted him to do another film, a sequel to Yojimbo. So he just pretty much took the storyline of Peaceful Days and added Shinjiro into it. So what this story consists of is, again, Shinjiro, sleeping in an abandoned temple. He overhears 9 young samurai talk about how the chamberlain that they all know that there's a corruption in their guild. They go to the chamberlain and ask for him to do some kind of overview, and he refuses, and they go to one of the men who are lower than him, and they decide. And overall, it's what happens is that these 9 novice, these 9 naive samurai are automatically wilted their fate because they went to this other member of their guild, this other high ranking member, to tell them about the corruption. When he is the one, and 2 of the other men are corrupt as well. So 3 of them are the corrupt, and this is while the head of their clan is away on business. So Shinjiro, being the smarter one of the 10, kind of, you know, halts them from going to do with the thing, because they're automatically, you know, they're causing a suicide mission practically. You know, they're going to go back to the higher statesmen, and they're going to be killed, and then be blamed for being the ones who are corrupt. So, and the one of the more smarter ones of the 9 men is the son of the nephew of the chamberlain. And even though Shinjiro is trying his best to give them, you know, kind of guidance in a way, and also sets plans up and whatnot, they keep bungling and fumbling up his plans, which really kind of drives him nuts. You know, and he gets really frustrated with these 9 men because they are naive and stupid, as he would constantly refer to them as. Like I said, this film was an adaptation of a story called Peaceful Days, but because Yojimbo was so successful, Toho wanted him to do another film. This film was released in Japan in 1962, but not for almost a year and a half. It didn't show up in America until May of 1963. So it was released on January 1st of 1962, and it didn't show up into America until May 7th, 1963. Problem with this? I don't know. There's no background story to this. But Shinjiro actually has a big adversary in this film. Called Himbe. This man called Himbe, who is one of the higher ranking samurai. He also works for the corrupt higher ups, and he's probably the smartest. He's pretty much Shinjiro's adversary in the whole film, just like the one Iwo in Yojimbo, who had the pistol. He was the biggest adversary in that film. And I think it's pretty much played by the same character, too. Gotta look. Shiro Yunda. No, can't be. I thought it was... I can't find it. I'm not even going to try. Oh, wait. 62, 63. Yes. He was 60. It's the same character. He's pretty much playing another role. What's the guy's name now? Tsuka Nodakadai. I think I'm getting that right. I think that's the right person. Because Kurosawa's films had a huge stock of people that he constantly used. He always recast them in films. He was never a person who went out of his stock of people he had. And plus, because I think there was the whole Toho Studios ideas that, you know, they like the old studio idea, like back in the 50s with American studios, you know, you had a person on contract at all times to do films. And I think it's also because he was probably more careful with the people he was with to do it. Yeah, I think that's who it is. I'm not sure. They're not giving me much on Wiki about who it is. But Himbei is probably the smartest one of them all. And you get this really great scene at the end of the film when him and Shinjiro confront each other. Or he confronts Shinjiro. Because he's duped him and he can't go back to, you know, he can't go back to where he belonged. You know, because he'd feel like a fool. So he just wants to have one last, you know, test of strength with this man, test of width and the fact of a duel. And this is another thing that you can see in spaghetti westerns, the whole idea of a duel at the end of a film. This film is a lot more action oriented than it's a lot less taking on the John Ford mentality and then just taking on straight on action film. There's a lot of this film is a lot more looser than the first film. It's not as even though people say it's more this film's funnier. I think this film is a little more headstrong. I think the character Shinjiro is he's much more of a powerful character in this because he's kind of watching these nine ducklings, I guess you can say, protecting them as best he can. Even though he really doesn't want anything to do with the stupidity that they keep doing. You know, I mean, they take care, they take prisoner this one man, and he sits in the closet the whole time. Like, they locked him up and tied him up in the closet. And so they've rescued his aunt and his cousin, so her daughter. But the chamberlain's still locked up and trying to be prosecuted. Like, they're trying to force a confession on him, but he won't do it. So they take hostage this guy, lock him in the closet. His aunt, you know, unlocks him in the closet to feed him because she feels bad that he's sitting in the closet. And for the rest of the film, he stays in the closet. It's one of the funnier moments in the film. He stays in the closet and only pops his head out when he thinks, when he wants to give opinion or give an idea for a raid or whatever the hell they're doing. Even at the end when they realize that he's the one who realizes that the place that they're sending all the men out to for the ambush is actually doesn't have a second floor because that's where Shinjiro says he was sleeping when he heard them talking. And again, it's the same thing with Shinjiro. He's playing the other team, thinking that he's going to be a good guy, you know, a man who just wants to get paid. You know, he's a wonderful samurai looking for money. He doesn't really care for anyone or anything, you know. The mother in the film, the guy's aunt, pretty much calls Shinjiro a dirty sword, a sword without a sheath. And also he incites that to Himbei at the very end of the film, that the two of them were the same. And in fact, it's a great battle of mind chess between the two of those men on who's able to outsmart the other one. That's ultimately what ends with the sword fight at the very end. It's not even a sword fight, it's just a duel. It's whoever can pull their sword out fast enough and kill the other. And ultimately it's one of the more brilliant black and white full-on gusher scenes that you ever get to see. When they do the fight and Shinjiro wins, he does get his sword out faster and he's able to cut him across his chest, and as he does that, his whole body explodes in an eruption of blood. And from what I've read and what I've heard in the commentary was that in that scene, the actor actually had to, you know, he was being the pressure from all the blood and everything from the pumps was so intense that it almost pushed him. It was pushing him off his feet. It took him so much to keep his feet like planted to the ground where he wouldn't be bursted up. And it's another interesting story. I think if you're gonna watch either of these, they're both black and white films. If you don't know, Yes, it's 62, and there was color at the time, but these films really do well as black and white films because they're portraying the time period that it is. I forget. It's got to be post American occupation. When the Americans came in with their weapons and stuff like that, even though this film doesn't have any modern weaponry in it, like in the first, it's still, you can see that the towns and the people are modernizing, which it did take a long time for the Japanese to modernize. Blech. And it's definitely that time period after when samurai really weren't that particularly needed. And so a lot of them roamed aimlessly from town to town looking for work. It's definitely something different. I mean, if you're like me, I'm a big fan of the Lone Wolf and Cub films, Lady Snowblood films. So when I first, picked these up and I sat down to watch them, I was kind of really taken aback because I was expecting something great, but I wasn't expecting something this great. And overall, I think it's because of Kurosawa's direction and his writing. It's again written by the same two people, Rizuro Kazumaya and Kurosawa. And I think it's also because of Mifune. I think Mifune, even as he got older, I think he was in his 30s by now, late 30s by now when he was doing these films. He died in 97, so he died the year before Kurosawa did, but I think he was, I forget. He had to be in his 40s. But he kept doing really great film. And he was probably in his 30s. But he was, he kept doing great film. And when other great actors, like men I look up to, like Sonny Chiba, would, continue this kind of reign of these really strong action samurai films. And you can see it in, Samurai Executioner, can't think of any of those, but you could see it in those films that they're taking heavily from films like this and Yojimbo and Seven Samurai, Sword of Doom and stuff like that, where they're taking the same kind of Oda, and the same kind of ideas, and they're running more wild with them though, in those kind of films. But overall, I'd say to pick them up, and I don't mean to just sound like a rush job, but I do enjoy them very much. And I think if this is your introduction to Kurosawa, I think this is a great way to start because these are probably the most action-oriented. I know Seven Samurai is an action film, but it's a 3.5-hour film, 3.5-hour-long film, and it's much more about the conflict of human relations and whatnot than a samurai film. Magnificent Seven would take that film, take that concept and throw it, up in the air and really make an interesting Americanized version of it. But if you want to start anywhere, I'd definitely try, rent these. Like I said, you can get them through Love Film and Zip.ca, also in Netflix. Netflix, you can get them through streaming or through hard disk in your mailbox. I think, if I'm correct, Love Film, you can only get them straight to your mailbox, and I think also Zip.ca. But supposedly, the Canadians are going to be getting Netflix streaming very soon, so you might be able to see this on your TV. I do apologize if this sounds a little crappy. I'm kind of working on a weird schedule. But besides that, I really shouldn't explain anymore. We will be back with a normal show in a handful of days. If you want to get in touch with me, you don't need to get in touch with me. You know all the things. I'm not really going to go into it. This is a special, so whatever. That's pretty much all I have to say. So if you have any comments, questions, problems, you want to correct me on anything, it's mushpixmassacre@gmail.com. I can't think of the voicemail right now. So mushpixmassacre@gmail.com. You have any problems, there's a comment. Go to the website, mushpixmassacre.wordpress.com or mushpixmassacre.com, and comment on there if you have any comments or you want to correct me on something or you want to continue a story, you want to continue a conversation. That would be awesome. And I hope you have a good time. I hope you enjoy this. And I will see you soon. Goodbye. Yeah.